DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Sarah Steffen. This week we'll talk about work. From former gang members who struggle to reintegrate into the workforce because their tattoos mark them for life, to automation taking away jobs. We have it all.
Korea is very much bonded by relationships. And once you form a relationship, a lot of South Koreans feel pained to cut that relationship. That includes hiring and firing of people. I think that relationship factor that's unique to the Confucian element in South Korea may be a reason why people are opting more towards automation. This is a faceless technological device that can be used and thrown away when not needed, but people don't feel the same way about humans.
We'll also hear how Haitians in the U.S. are coping after U.S. President Donald Trump terminated their temporary protected status that allowed them to legally live and work in the country. Stick around for all that and more on DW's World in Progress. Let's start with South Korea, where picking up a drink or even an entire meal from a convenience store is part of daily life. There's an estimated 40,000 of these shops all over the country. And along with the increase of single households, the number of these 24-hour retailers is expected to also be on the rise. But not all of them will have staff working behind the counter. Some franchises are rolling out fully automated convenience stores. And that's bad news for employees who depend on minimum wage. Jason Strother takes us on a tour of one of these unmanned shops in Seoul.
Door's open.
To get into a staffless convenience store, you first have to insert a credit card into the door. Usually when you enter a convenience store in South Korea, the staff greet you. Not here. I'm the only person inside. It's silent, except for the hum of refrigerators and the instrumental soundtrack that plays from speakers on the ceiling. And while this shop has most of the usual products you'd expect to find in a convenience store, like cups of instant ramen noodles, triangle-shaped seaweed-wrapped rice snacks, and sausages on sticks, there's a noticeable absence from the beverage section: alcohol. By taking booze off the shelves, this franchise prevents teenage shoppers from breaking the law. It also locks up cigarettes in a credit card-only vending machine. And to prevent shoplifting, there are closed-circuit televisions. While I'm waiting around, a customer comes in. She grabs a few items off the shelves and heads to the register, which is just a touchscreen kiosk with a barcode reader. The computer asks her to scan her purchases and pay with a card. She tells me her name is Kim Young, and she's in her 40s, and she's a regular here.
Do you come to this Pyeonijeom often?
Yes, every day. When I come to the office, I drop by here and buy something to eat for breakfast.
Oh, okay.
Apple and banana and the coffee.
Do you think this is nicer than a convenience store with staff?
More convenience for me without person.
Why is that? Why?
I think it's just time saving.
But if customers do have a problem checking out, there's a number they can call for help. I give it a ring. I ask the agent if he gets a lot of calls from customers who have difficulty using the touchscreen computer. The agent says no. Most people who call just want to return something. He says staff do come to the store in the mornings for a few hours and can make exchanges. E-Mart 24, the retailer that runs this shop, operates around 3,000 branches nationwide, but only 5 are unmanned. They started this trial run last year and have no plans to expand yet. But convenience stores aren't the only businesses trying out automation. Some fast food restaurants have already replaced staff at the counter with machines that take orders. Jasper Kim, who lectures in the Division of International Studies at Ewha Women's University in Seoul and specializes in business law, says computerized systems will hurt workers that are already in the most vulnerable part of South Korea's economy, those who earn minimum wage.
People that aren't highly educated, who drop out of high school, or maybe they've attended college and there's some circumstances in their family, maybe one of their parents got ill, where they're looking for jobs like this, but they get displaced by technology.
Kim says there are plenty of reasons why convenience store owners would want to switch to an automated system.
Korea is very much bonded by relationships. And once you form a relationship, a lot of South Koreans feel pained to cut that relationship. That includes hiring and firing of people. I think that relationship factor that's unique to the Confucian element in South Korea may be a reason why people are opting more towards automation. This is a faceless technological device that can be used and thrown away when not needed, but people don't feel the same way about humans.
Another factor is pure economics. Earlier this year, South Korea's minimum wage rose to about €5.75 per hour, a 16% increase. And according to media reports here, employers responded by laying off workers. That's what John Lee did. He runs a convenience store outside of Seoul. I caught up with him during a coffee break.
I'm not in the charity business. I'm in the business to make money. And if I don't make money, that's money out of my own pocket. So unfortunately, I did have to lay off workers because of the wage going up.
Lee now puts in 12 hours a day himself at his store. He says switching to a self-service kiosk would save him even more money, but he explains there's a lot of competition between convenience stores in Korea, and he says the only reason that keeps customers coming back to any particular store is the relationship they feel they have with the person behind the counter.
You know, the person knows what kind of brand of cigarettes you smoke. You have a brief exchange with the person every morning. You say, good morning, how are the kids? These are the kinds of things that will get a person to keep coming back, a customer loyalty. But if you walk into a store and there's no one else but just a cash register and you just pick something and scan it yourself and pay for it, well, that's not so personal anymore.
He's hoping customers will value personal interaction over high-tech stores without any staff. Back at the staff-less convenience store, I meet up with Kim Dong-hyun, who used to work part-time at a 24-hour shop. We pick up some drinks.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Dong-hyun, who's 33, has a full-time job as a translator for an embassy in Seoul. He says working at a convenience store helped him make ends meet.
My salary at the embassy, I wouldn't say how much because it's I can't support myself and I have to send the money to my family back in Busan. And I also pay rent. I also spend money for myself, buy something, eat something, and that costs a lot. So that's the first, main reason I started to look at the second job.
Dong-hyun says it was only a matter of time before machines took these jobs away from young workers. According to the Korean Employment Information Service, up to 12% of Korean wage earners have already lost their jobs to automation, and that number will continue to rise. But it's still too soon to tell if customers will warm up to non-human interactions. Dong-hyun and I dispose of our empty cans before we leave the shop. It's a little odd not to say goodbye or thank you to the person behind the counter. Jason Strother, DW, Seoul.
Let's stay in South Korea. It's been about a year since Moon Jae-in took over as president, replacing disgraced former president Park Geun-hye, who is serving 24 years in prison. In terms of foreign policy, Moon has already forged a closer relationship with North Korea. At home, though, it's all about jobs for young people who struggle to find employment. Katrin Erdmann went to see how they're faring. And her report is presented by Ineke Mules.
It's a hot, sunny afternoon, and around 100 young adults are sitting on staircase-style benches. They are at the job center in the center of South Korea's capital, Seoul.
Here, staff from the employment agency are explaining to the young people how they can find a job, how to write an application, what the requirements would be. This allows job seekers to find out whether they have the relevant qualifications.
That's Ruby Yuri. She organised this three-hour event. An agency staff member has just talked about the last tunnel on the way to adulthood. What they mean is this one application that will lead to a full-time job. That's what Min Jong is hoping for. The 29-year-old is an English teacher, but for the last 4 months she's been unemployed. She's now looking for a new position within educational administration. She needs help.
I haven't prepared for applying for a private company, so I need some information how to apply for that.
The change in career direction is not coincidental. It highlights one of South Korea's other problems.
Actually, these days, it's very really competitive to be a public school teacher because the children are getting less and less. Many Korean students want to be competitive when they apply for their college, so they are now more focused on their other subjects like Korean language or mathematics. So English subject has lost their importance in Korean curriculum.
Min Jong is skeptical that she will find something in the near future. There are a few vacancies in the industry. The number of unemployed 15 to 29-year-olds in South Korea has even risen since the more liberal President Moon entered office. It is now at almost 12%. That puts a damper on the mood of Korea's young people, says Ruby Yuri of the employment agency.
The lack of jobs means that the young applicants are resigned. We're trying to motivate them and to tell them it's not your fault that there are so few free positions.
That's true for 29-year-old Min Jung. She has been unemployed for half a year, but she finds, like 83% of South Koreans according to a recent survey, that the government has done well for its first year. And that is not just down to the current program at the job centre. Over the last 6 months, Min Jung has received the equivalent of around 380 euros per month. Before, this support had only lasted for a month, but Min Jung is pessimistic. She doesn't believe she'll find a job anytime soon.
I didn't study about my subject for 2 years, so I forgot everything.
She was in Australia for a year and then took a year's break. That's brave in a country like Korea, where professional success depends on the right school, the right university, and how much money one can pay for education. Big business dictates everything. President Moon was brought in to break this link between politics and business. According to Kim Nuri, professor for German literature and cultural studies at the Chung-ang University in Seoul, more needs to happen.
I would sometimes call Korea a capital dictatorship. Moon Jae-in wants to make some reasonable reforms, but that is insufficient.
Moon has failed to reduce the big gap between rich and poor. More than half of low-income earners have even said that over the last year, their economic situation has deteriorated, according to a Korean Gallup Institute survey. Kim Nuri mentions the university landscape as an example.
In Korea,
public universities make up only 13% of universities. 87% are private, world class. This privatization of universities is because policy has moved exclusively in the direction of a free market economy.
Change will not be swift, says Nuri. Still, the government has raised the minimum wage, an important first step for Korea, the professor believes. Back at the job centre, the last presentation has ended. After the applause, it's orange juice and sandwiches for the participants. It might not be much, but the young people hope that soon there will be more on offer.
Ineke Mules with a report by Katrin Erdmann. You're listening to DW's World in Progress with me, Sarah Steffen. Online, we're at dw.com/worldinprogress. You can also listen to us on iTunes or SoundCloud. and check out DW Global Society on Facebook. Let's go to El Salvador now, where gang brutality is so rife that it has become one of the most dangerous countries in the world outside a war zone. In 2017, the smallest and most densely populated country in Central America experienced an average of more than 10 murders a day. For many, there's little hope for a normal life after time spent in a gang. Most of them won't be able to find a job, making reintegration into society even more difficult. But a few pastors and business owners are now giving them the opportunity to start over. Anna Catherine Brigida reports from El Salvador.
Oswaldo Enriquez wears jeans and a gray short-sleeved t-shirt as he packs boxes of clothes to be shipped to Harvard, Princeton, Columbia, and dozens of other U.S. universities. The 31-year-old is like many other employees at League Central America, a textile factory in El Salvador about 45 minutes outside the capital. He's working to support his family, a wife and 6-year-old son. But when Enriquez rolls up his sleeves, some people see him differently. He has tattoos on his upper arms, chest, and back, revealing his past as a gang member.
For me, I thought there was no more future for me in this country because I had tattooed my body.
In El Salvador, tattoos make Enriquez nearly unemployable. Few companies will hire former gang members. Many Salvadorans just don't believe people like Enriquez can change. Others think they should be behind bars for their crimes. League Central America, where Enriquez has worked for 4 years, saw past his tattoos. CEO Rodrigo Bolaños has hired more than 100 reformed gang members since 2009, when he returned to his native El Salvador after working in Guatemala for 7 years. While there, he saw how violence affected his employees. He returned determined to do his part to reduce violence in his own country. His approach can be called corporate social responsibility or responsible capitalism.
It sends a message that we have to embrace the community if we want to have a healthy country.
Not everyone in El Salvador agrees with Bolaños' approach. That's understandable. In 2017, nearly 4,000 people were murdered in El Salvador, a country the size of Slovenia with a population of 6.5 million. Gangs are responsible for 60% of homicides. The country's two main gangs, 18th Street and MS-13, have roots on the streets of Los Angeles. Salvadoran immigrants fled the country's civil war that started in 1980. They arrived during LA's bloody gang turf wars. For protection, young Salvadoran immigrants joined either 18th Street, a mainly Mexican gang, or the newly formed Mara Salvatrucha, or MS-13. When the war ended in 1992, the U.S. government decided it was time to deport any Salvadoran with a criminal record. El Salvador was unprepared to reintegrate returning gang members. So the gangs flourished. Poverty, inequality, and a weak rule of law have persisted in El Salvador in the post-war era, creating the perfect conditions for gangs to thrive. When Enriquez was a teenager, most of his childhood friends started joining 18th Street Gang. By 14, he was an official member with the tattoos to prove it. His decision devastated his mother, Anna Jeanette Garcia.
I don't know what I did wrong. Why did he do it if I've given everything for him? I was always a good mum to him. I don't know what happened. Maybe it was from hanging out with the wrong crowd.
Garcia feared her son's seemingly inevitable fate. Mothers know that their sons who join gangs usually end up dead or in jail within 5 years. Enriquez was soon in trouble with the law. He was arrested twice, once in 2006 and again in 2009, both times for small offenses with quick releases. The second time, a police officer gave Enriquez a piece of advice that stuck with him.
I remember that day that a police officer, a sergeant, told me, change, he said, go to church, he told me. You're so angry, you're so harsh, change, look for a way.
Being in the gang is for life, they say. But after that encounter, Enriquez decided he wanted to leave gang life behind. He knew he couldn't fully reject his gang, but he could go calmado, or calm. Going calmado means the gang approves the decision to stop being active. When Enriquez approached the gang leaders, they didn't all agree.
One said to me, "Why are you going to leave the gang if out there no one is going to lend you a hand? No one is going to help you. No one is going to help you like the gang does." They were true words in a way because no one wants to help a gang member outside of the gang.
But some do help, particularly evangelical pastors, such as Carlos Nieto at the church in Apopa, El Salvador, where Enriquez lives.
God, in his word, says that he's not interested in our past. What he's interested in is what you want to do today, in the present.
Enriquez doesn't hide his past, but he also doesn't shout it from the rooftops. Most people working in gang intervention in El Salvador prefer not to know details of crimes committed. So this is all Enriquez would tell me.
The truth is that now I feel guilty because I did something without having a reason. Now, sometimes at night, I think about the pain that I've caused that person. And if I see him one day, I would apologize for the hurt that I did to him.
His past stirs up emotions. Pain, guilt, shame. Dealing with these feelings is why he hasn't skipped church in 8 years. And the difficulty of confronting the past, both for Enriquez and for Salvadoran society, is why reintegration of gang members is so complicated. Enriquez wakes up before 5 a.m. every weekday for his long commute to the factory. On weekends, he studies to get an associate's degree through a partnership with the private university arranged by his job. He spends free time with family or at church. His life now is nothing like his life years ago as an active gang member.
I say that a gang member can really change because I've seen it in me and I've seen it in other people too. It's just about a lack of opportunity. If they give these opportunities, I know a gang member can change and the country can be different.
For DW, this is Anna Catherine Brigida in Ciudad Arce and Apopa, El Salvador.
Little Haiti is a neighborhood in Miami, Florida, in the U.S., where many Haitians came when large-scale immigration to the U.S. began during the 1970s. Asylum seekers arrived by boat to escape Haiti's brutal dictatorship. More came in 2010 after a devastating earthquake destroyed the country. They were allowed to live and work in the U.S. under what's called Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. But U.S. President Donald Trump ended the program early in his term, effectively kicking them out of the country by July next year. Many Haitians have already left Little Haiti. Their exodus is taking a toll both on the community and the economy, as Maria Bacalapolo reports.
My name is Farah Larieux. I am an entrepreneur.
Farah Larieux is one of the TPS recipients who has to leave the country next year. She came to the U.S. after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti and has been here ever since.
What this administration, Donald Trump, is doing is unfair. This is a crime against humanity. My immigration status become a barrier for me. I cannot even focus on build my life. We hope that we have a better life here, but we're not welcome because of our color of our skin, because of the country where we come from, and that's sad. Facing this, that means, hey, the American dream is not for everybody.
Along with running her own communications company, Larieux is also a community activist and plans to fight to stay in the U.S. The 2018 midterm elections this November is approaching. All 435 seats are up for election every 2 years. Since the Senate term is 6 years, 35 of the 100 seats are being voted on. 39-year-old Larieux says the best chance to keep TPS alive is if the Republican Party loses power in at least one branch of government.
I'm working with a different organization to continue to keep the conversation about immigration and educate the voters. We send to Congress people that represent us.
When President Trump spoke to the people in Little Haiti back in 2016 during his election campaign, he insisted he would be their greatest champion. Now nearly 60,000 Haitians have to leave the United States by July 22, 2019, after their Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, runs out or face deportation. An estimated 24,000 of them are living in South Florida. The effect on the Haitians on TPS here in Miami is profound, says Lariu. Even though she still has another year, there is the fear that the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, or ICE, will pick them up for questioning ahead of the deadline.
You don't know how your future look. You don't know where you're going. Some people, they have been living in this country for over 20 years. They don't know anything else. Some people, they have children who were born and raised in the United States. Some people who came after the earthquake, they have lost everything. So how you think that you're going to tell to that person to go back to Haiti? Some people even are so afraid, so depressed that they don't go out. They're afraid to go to the church. They're afraid to go to the supermarket because they're afraid that they will deport them. Even their work permit, the TPS say that, okay, you're still legal in the country. The fear is real every day. And because of that, some people, they just get everything they could get. Their belonging they could put in a bag, and then they went to the Canadian border.
Since last May, thousands of Haitian immigrants have been steadily pouring into Canada, mostly on foot at the Quebec border, in an attempt to flee aggressive anti-immigration policies by the Trump administration. Since President Donald Trump was elected, 27,000 asylum seekers have crossed the border into Canada, including Haitians, Nigerians, and Syrians. The U.S. Congress created TPS in the Immigration Act of 1990. It is a temporary status provided to nationals of specifically designated countries that are confronting an ongoing armed conflict, environmental disaster, or extraordinary and temporary conditions. It allows them to temporarily live and work in the United States. But no administration has yet ended the status, allowing TPS recipients to renew on an 18-month basis. Ending it now all of a sudden is problematic, says Jepsy Metalou, the executive director at Haitian Neighborhood Center Saint-La.
If you grant that status and you say it's for 18 months, then let it be for 18 months. Don't renew it and renew it year after year, allowing these people to then build lives, thinking, well, you know, it was renewed, and here's the fifth year that it's renewed. Suddenly you're in this country 10 years, and in 10 years you have children, you invest in yourself and invest in your home, and 15 years later you're told, okay, sorry, you've got to go.
She says the exodus of Haitians would have a profound impact on Florida's economy.
I know that employers would complain because then they would be short very significant and very important workforce. And this is from the health sector to education to universities to agriculture. You name the sector, it would be impacted by the sudden loss of so many workers. And so I think our economy would suffer, right, if this came to pass. And then, of course, what's it going to cost to repatriate all these people?
Little Haiti's bookstore, Library Mapu, has been a cultural gathering spot for the last 25 years. 76-year-old owner John Mapu sought political asylum in America in 1969. According to Mapu, the neighborhood suffers the loss of business from the panicked departure of Haitians, fearful of Trump's immigration policies. Mapu recognizes the future is not bright. Additionally, wedged between the trendy Wynwood and the Design District and Biscayne Boulevard, hungry developers are eager to move north as those areas become saturated, so they continue to raise rents in Little Haiti, driving local Haitian businesses out. The streets of Little Haiti are much quieter these days because of these two factors.
Haitians are going to Canada. They are going to Chile, to Brazil. First of all, they cannot go back to Haiti. They have nothing in Haiti. How they are going to start all over in Haiti? Everybody is scared. It is a panic.
For DW, I'm Maria Bacalopoulou in Miami, Florida.
And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Iliana Gagliarducci and Jürgen Kuhn. I'm Sarah Steffen, and this was World in Progress. Bye for now.